Welcome to the 142nd episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. Welcome. I finished my marathon, and I live to tell about it. So I just got back from Sacramento on Sunday. Had a nice little visit with a registered dietitian named Timmerie Hagenberger, and today I have our own Jamie Delaney practice registered dietitian Addie Delaney Meinrich with me. So welcome, Addie.
Hello, everyone.
So the marathon went good. Didn't do any crazy nutritional goofiness. We had some good Thai food beforehand. It was nice. The pre-race dinner had a big salad buffet, so I had salads. I was able to get my beets. They actually had sweet potatoes and beans, so I had chickpeas and kidney beans and sweet potatoes and mixed greens. Earlier, my Thai food had, I did a cauliflower green curry that had broccoli and cabbage in it, so I loaded up on the greens beforehand. And before the race, I typically eat a bonk bar and a banana about 2 hours before, and that's what I did this time and ran. And I take in a combination of Goose and which is the brand, which are just carbohydrates. And then there's a new one that I took this time that I think was beneficial because I get to the point where I can't tolerate the Goose just because it's just so sugary. But there's one called Huma. And it's with chia seeds in brown rice syrup. So that tended to go down good. So I did one of those at the halfway point and then one of those at about mile 17, 18. And that seemed to break things up. They also had Cliff gels on the course, and I did some of those. So I think breaking up different flavors, different consistencies made it easier for my gut to tolerate. And then I just drank water. And then afterwards, we had some fruit, and the race, we did a VIP package. If you ever get a chance to do the California International Marathon, I recommend the VIP package because they take you out in a heated bus, and you have a heated tent right by the start, and then when you finish, you go into the Sutter House, get your clothes, some warm clothes, and it's warm inside. And they had breakfast, and they had high apple cider and a fruit bowl, and some then non-plant-based things, but nevertheless, we got some different. I actually had some tomato juice, a little bit of salt in there, and then we went down to Timmerie's and had a foodie bar pancake style breakfast for dinner with a bunch of different sauces that she made. Had oat pancakes as well as some teff pancakes. She also made us a big bowl of her famous kale with red cabbage and her cheesy parm on top, so that was good. And she made some zucchini muffins, so she filled us up pretty good, sent us on our way. So it was a good trip. So today, I guess getting to the main subject of thing, we're going to talk about celiac disease, gluten intolerance, and wheat allergies. And it's a difficult subject. There's so much, if you look at plant-based nutrition by itself, it's difficult to figure things out, vegan versus plant-based versus whole foods versus, but then you add the gluten part into things and it can be really, really confusing. And, when I was in medical school way back in the late 80s, celiac disease was something that was diagnosed. And typically I can remember people coming in with a lot of weight loss. They may have had symptoms for years on end, diarrhea, malabsorption. And, a lot of testing was done before finally figured out, what they had. And that's not all that uncommon. People can suffer a long time. Celiac disease can actually manifest in adulthood or in childhood, but it typically presents with diarrhea, weight loss, and some source of malnutrition. Meaning people can have anemia. They can, adults can get osteoporosis. There's a whole myriad of symptoms. The genetics associated, the genotype associated with celiac disease is HLA-DQ2 or HLA-DQ8. 40% of the population have this genotype, but only about 2 to 3% actually develop celiac disease, which is, you know, the development of these specific autoantibodies against tissue TG2. So that, along with the pathological diagnosis and an endoscopy showing that the villi are flattened, pretty much confirms the disease. And this abnormal small bowel is what causes all the malabsorption symptoms. Non-celiac gluten sensitivity is used to describe individuals who have signs and symptoms of gluten intolerance, whether it be the intestinal symptoms or the body aches and joint aches. And when they get rid of gluten, the symptoms get better. It's more difficult because there aren't any biomarkers associated with gluten sensitivity. There is a suggested increased immune response in gluten sensitivity, and it may have to do with alpha amylase trypsin inhibitors and some other roles as far as T cell regulation. So there's definite pathological findings with the immune response in these individuals, but not the genetic markers. There's also a true wheat sensitivity, and a wheat allergy is more common in kids. It can happen in 2 to 9% of kids, and it typically presents with kind of anaphylaxis type symptoms of swelling, the eyes, itching of the mouth, throat, and skin, and even difficulty breathing. So this is a quick onset type reaction. The other differential include a small bowel bacterial overgrowth and irritable bowel syndrome. So we won't go into that very much, but those again can really confound the diagnosis. It's important to make a diagnosis of celiac disease, because not making the diagnosis leads to worsening small bowel function and worsening malabsorption, but also there's a risk for T-cell lymphomas down the road. So it's not something that you want to fool around with and just play for and try to figure out the diagnosis on your own. What are your thoughts, Addie, when you see people that come in with some of these symptoms? What's the natural progression for you?
Well, I mean, it is, like you said before, it's not the easiest thing to diagnose, just because if you are gluten sensitive, or wheat sensitive, or have IBS, you know, or have, you know, different gastrointestinal issues, they can present themselves in different forms. So you don't have to check all the boxes. Some people may only have a couple of the symptoms. You know, some people may have chronic migraines and like a foggy mind, it's described as, and fatigue. You know, and maybe they won't get the severe bloating as some people, and some people have like the eczema and dermatitis symptoms. And then some people do have the significant bloating and digestion issues. So it is difficult to just come out with a flat diagnosis, which is usually where a dietitian comes into play with helping people distinguish what is actually triggering their symptoms. So when it starts to talk about, you know, or starts to present as, you know, digestion related, then we start looking at the foods you're eating. Typically, you know, instead of just flat out saying it's gluten, if people are still eating animal products, you know, my first look is at how much dairy they're eating, because people who have, you know, lactose intolerance, and even if it doesn't present as flat out lactose intolerance, you know, studies have shown the negative effects of dairy on, you know, headaches, muscle and joint pain with the increased inflammation in your body, you know, skin irritations, as well as digestion issues. So I typically almost tend to look at dairy first. And once we can eliminate dairy from someone's diet, sometimes those symptoms go away. Now, if they are still present or lessened but still present, then I'll start looking a little bit more. And we usually do that through, I'll either have people journal for me for a week or two exactly what they're eating, and not only when they're eating, but their emotions around when they're eating, as well as the symptoms afterwards. Because when you get into the areas of IBS, which is irritable bowel syndrome, versus a gluten sensitivity, which the two can go hand in hand, but if it's one or the other, it's more of the emotion, or not always the emotions, but it can be, you know, around the emotions of eating, especially if you are getting these uncomfortable symptoms. You know, people have a fear of eating that can be related to that if I'm diagnosed for a certain period of time. So I have them log that so that, you know, since I can't go home with everybody and see what everyone's doing, I try to paint the best picture as I can. So down the line, if we do start to think that it is a gluten and or wheat sensitivity, then we start with the elimination process. I look at the foods that they're eating that have gluten in them, whether it is, you know, pastas, breads, pastries, baked goods, you know, as well as there's some soups prepackaged. A lot of prepackaged foods and processed foods, they sneak wheat into things. If you have a severe sensitivity and celiac, it's also good to note at this point too that you need to look for specifically gluten-free labeled items. So certain items such as, you know, oats do not have naturally occurring gluten in them. They have a protein called avenin in them, which is very similar to gluten, but does not trigger celiac responses. But, you know, companies such as Quaker also produce items that have wheat in them. So if things are not labeled gluten-free, you know, you need to stray away from those with celiac. Now with gluten intolerance, you may not have, depending on the severity of the issue, as much of an issue with cross-contamination, which is the production of foods on the same surface that could have, you know, allergic reactions in people. So we look at those items. I either find alternatives for people with different kinds of whole grains that do not contain gluten, such as, you know, oats, sorghum, millet, brown rice, buckwheat, amaranth, quinoa, corn, and teff, all of which do not have gluten in them, you know, as well as some nut flours that they have developed along the way. So we swap those things out. So we kind of eliminate it from your diet completely. Now, some physicians and dietitians will either have, especially if you go to a food sensitivity specialist, will either have, you know, anywhere from a month to a whole year of a patient not having these foods which contain gluten in their diet to kind of reset yourself, see if that's the issue, and then we go through a process of reintroduction of these foods into your diet to see if it was, you know, an inflammatory response by the body that wasn't related to the gluten but was presenting alongside of the gluten, or if it is true that you have a true allergy to them. So, you know, it is a long process, and it's, you know, being very aware of the foods you're putting in your body, cross-contamination issues. So that also includes if you're eating out, asking waiters and waitresses, you know, how things are prepared, if using the same cutting board, same cooking areas. So just being very aware of what's going on. And then if it turns out to be, you know, a true gluten intolerance where you cannot have it in your diet, then, you know, we go from there as to, you know, how to substitute and get you the foods and recipes that you've always loved, but do it in a way that is healthy for you.
Well, and then, like you said before, a lot of products, especially baked goods, may contain dairy and eggs. And so dairy and eggs can also be triggered as an allergen or a sensitivity, and then the wheat gets blamed, so you're not always sure. And then what about if people are gluten, gluten intolerant or have a gluten sensitivity, but they're not celiac. I know that the average gluten intake is about 10 to 20 grams a day in the standard American diet, so to speak. But there are minimally processed gluten containing like freca and barley and spelt and kamut and ferret. Would you introduce these to those people that are gluten intolerant gradually, just because it would broaden the ability of them to get in some different grains, perhaps?
You could, you know, if they're not trying out these other grains that I said, you know, before. Also, that would be another way to reintroduce the gluten protein complex without introducing the wheat, because then that goes to a different avenue, that, you know, to make this whole picture even more complicated. You know, the whole new findings that people could just have a specific wheat allergy, because gluten, as we know, is also found, the complex is found in barley and rye. So if you can tolerate barley and rye with no problem, it's more likely to be a wheat allergy. So then you have to look on labels for not just, you know, gluten-free, but just anything that has a wheat product in it.
And then, you know, we know that, you know, grains were introduced to the diet about 10,000 years ago. And actually the diagnosis of celiac disease was made, you know, way back in the 1930s. And specifically, people started to make the diagnosis the end of World War II, just for FYI, because there was such a food shortage and a wheat allergy. A lot of people that were very sick when the wheat was not available actually got a little bit better. It's kind of interesting, you know. The incidence of heart disease improved in Norway when they couldn't get dairy and beef, because they're such a big dairy and beef eaters, and so we took the wheat out. People got a little bit better as well. So sometimes forced elimination can kind of help make the diagnosis. You know, just to be specific, we talked about it earlier. Gluten is a complex it's a complex protein made up of gliadin and glutenins. But gluten also has some benefits in your diet. So just to say we're not going to eat gluten is not necessarily just because, you know, it's a fad, or it may be. I think that we have to be very careful as well, because there's naturally occurring fructan type resistant starches in wheats called oligofructose and inulin. And that helps to actually create a healthy composition of gut bacteria, because we know that the other thing that we haven't mentioned is small bowel overgrowth, and that if you don't have celiac disease and you withhold gluten, then you may be risking changing your gut microbe, and you may increase your risk of this disease. We also know that there's actually a decreased incidence of heart disease in people that eat wheat products. So, you know, just to eliminate things, it's not necessarily, you know, what we want to do.
Yeah, you know, that's often a question, because it does seem like the subject of gluten-free everything has really been on the rise, and that's not uncommon for me to get the question of, well, what about gluten-free? Do I need to avoid gluten? Or I'll talk to just people randomly at the grocery store, and they'll be like, well, we're gluten-free, and I'm like, you know, I'll start to talk about the conversation. They're like, well, no, we just eliminated it to be healthier. And while, you know, people will say, well, I lost weight when I was gluten free, it's typically because they were big pasta and bread eaters and took those things out of their diet. So it's not the fact that the gluten is bad, it's overeating these processed and refined foods that are the problem.
Yes. Well, yes, in the American Heart Association, there was just a study published in 2017 where they followed 199,794 people. And the people that ate the most gluten actually had the lowest incidence of type 2 diabetes. There was actually a 13% reduction. If you look at the Harvard Public Health Study, 15% reduction in heart disease, 17% reduction in colon cancer for each 90-gram extra of whole grains a day. You know, unfortunately, we've went from whole grains to junk foods such as, you know, white flours and white pastas and you know, pizzas and hamburger buns and all those other things that you know, I've kind of I've tripped things up. But the presence of a whole grain heavy bread, a whole grain pasta, or wheat and barley can be very, you know, very, very beneficial in the diet. And then, of course, that turns us to, you know, again, just like you can be eat a junk food vegan diet, you can now, thanks to good old marketing, we can eat a junk food gluten-free diet. So, you know, what we'd like to talk about a little bit now is, you know, how to eat a whole food, plant-based, nutrient-dense, gluten-free diet. And we have some patients like that. And they, you know, it can be very overwhelming, especially when they're trying to do all of it at once.
Yeah. So, you know, when you, again, as you know, I did, you know, to be completely transparent, when we started to be plant-based and vegan as a family, I was off in college. I started on the frozen vegan foods and things of that nature that I wasn't making myself. And they were high in oils and fats and things like that. So what you get with the pre-made, you know, gluten-free cookies, breads, and frozen meals, that way you're getting a lot of oil, typically, a lot of processed sugars, and other binding agents such as, you know, collagen or other agents of that nature that you do not want in your body, and gelatin and things of that nature. So learning how to, if you want to do the breads and things of that nature, that you're learning how to create them on your own, or you're being aware of companies out there who maybe do grains, but they're doing it in a healthful way with not a bunch of chemical additives. Because at the end of the day, you're not helping your health by adding all these chemicals into your body just to help fix one of the issues.
So, yeah, and I think the other thing that I came across was, you know, if we can be very biased of what we think makes us feel good or feel bad. You know, I always, you know, it's when you get sick, and you know, you have a bellyache or you're really nauseated, and you typically blame the last thing you consumed. And it's not necessarily, you know, you may have got food poisoning that happened 24 hours, but when it really hit you, it was the last thing that you ate that might have been perfectly innocuous, but you blame it for years and years to come. And, you know, not only does that, but there was a study done looking at children that were being evaluated for gluten intolerance and or celiac disease, and they were given bread, and it was supposed to be a double-blind crossover study. But again, the parents were given the bread products, and they were given to the kids, and they had the parents guess. The parents would say, well, this one didn't work, or this one did work, and so the parents would be somewhat biased as to what they thought. If they thought the kid was getting gluten, then it's like, oh yeah, their activity was worse, their, you know, their symptoms were worse, when in reality they weren't very accurate, because they, you know, it was more of a biased thinking that they got it. So then they repeated the experiment with pills, capsules containing either gluten or non-gluten, so everything tasted the same and looked the same. And the reality of it is, it was very hard to predict, you know, whether these kids were getting it or not. So there's this subject bias. You know, if you eat something with the expectation that you're going to get sick, sometimes you do. You know, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it does help to work with a dietitian or a healthcare provider so that you can have some, you know, non-biased judgment and really sort through things, because it's become such a mass marketing thing. There's so many other things that can interfere. It can be really hard to tease out what's really the problem.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, the heart healthy craze when they put on, you know, the smart balance and the different oils, the big heart that says heart healthy because, you know, you're not eating the butter and animal fat. But we well know now, especially if you've been listening to this podcast, that those things, it's all marketing. So you have to be an advocate for yourself and learning what the ingredients are in foods that you are either preparing or buying, and, you know, knowing their effects on your body.
You know, that's, you know, I'm going to take a little time out just to talk a little bit about our practice and what we do different here as to a traditional medical practice. You know, I've spoken to a lot of dietitians at conferences and things, and it's like, I think a dietitian should be in every physician's office. And of course, you know, this is a plant-based practice. I'm a cardiologist, I'm an internist, but, you know, I also, you know, have incorporated you, a registered plant-based registered dietitian, so that we work as a team to help people identify these things, because it can take a long time, as you know, as I'm sure listeners know, and we know, to actually figure out what's going on. And you know, we're really enjoying the team approach here. You know, I speak with a patient, and Addie speaks with a patient, and the beauty of it is, Addie's in Atlanta, I'm in Port Charlotte, Florida. We can talk with people whether they're in Port Charlotte or any place in the world, and manage these Skype conversations and get a really good, accurate history about what people are doing and what their goals are and their plans. So if you haven't checked out our website at drdelaney.com, I'd invite you to do so. We'd be happy to talk with you on the phone if you have any questions, or email with you if you have any questions about the practice. But, you know, we've had a tremendous amount of success because, you know, we really want to get to the bottom of what's going on and how a person can achieve optimal health through nutrition, and specifically plant-based nutrition. And it can be very, very tricky. So, you know, give us a shout and look at things and give us a call if you're interested, because we have, again, multiple tiers, whether it's all online or conference call basis or in the office. So we're happy to meet with you and Skype and discuss all your issues. So given that, if we're going to try to do some gluten-free products, it can be a little bit of a challenge. I'm a big proponent of making my own things, because then I know what's in them. And typically, we can start with something as, you know, easy as some bread. I try to do a pizza crust, and before I kind of read any directions, I started making it mainly out of millet, and it wasn't raising very good. It was just kind of flat. And then when I start reading, it's like, oh, don't use all millet because it can be kind of sour tasting, and you know, it's not going to raise. And it kind of looked like wet sand at first. So then I started experimenting. I started adding rice flour to it, and it got a little bit better. And I added some oat flour to it, and it got a little bit better. And then I overbaked it, and then it became like a cracker. And, you know, so luckily we had some good toppings to put on top to hold it together. You were there visiting at the time, Addie. So it was a crust that you needed a lot of water with that particular crust. So since then, we've done a little research, and, you know, give us some tips, you know, as far as different flours to use and mixing techniques.
Well, the consensus, you know, like I said, we've done a little bit on our own, and we've done a little bit of research. So there are some tips on how to transition some of your recipes to be gluten-free that make things a little bit easier. Just because, you know, a lot of trouble that people have, like you said, are getting things to stick together, getting things to rise. So for starters, increasing your leavening agents, so your baking sodas and baking powders. So usually you want to increase them by around 25% to help move everything up, if you will. And then smaller is better. So, you know, making your cookies a little bit of a smaller size, making your loaves of bread, try to not pack as much batter in there. So they'll be a little bit smaller, you know. Any kind of, you know, pizza crust, things of that nature, not expanding and rolling them out as much, making more of a personal pizza size, which can be fun in itself. We don't want to be negative here. And then blending different flours together. So often, if you look at an all-purpose gluten-free flour, if you read the back, as you should with all things that you aren't preparing yourself, you will notice that there's several different kinds of gluten-free flours that they're combining in those mixes. So if you also look on a great, you know, blog, is Minimalist Baker. She does a lot of gluten-free recipes. So to swap out the oils in those, but you'll notice in her recipes, just to name one source, she always is mixing up a few different flours, and that always seems to help. Adding starches to the mix, can definitely help, as well as with digestion. And then some stickiness people like to add. So a sweet or like a rice flours are typically a little bit more sticky when saturated. And then different gums. I don't know, Mom, if you want to talk about the things that you've read about, you know, there's some controversy over, you know, guar gum or xanthan gum that, you know, whether they're good for you, whether they're bad for you, because they're all binders and they're kind of in the same category as gelatin, which is something that we don't want people eating. So what have you found on all that?
Well, if we, let's just we can break some of them down. Xanthan gum is one that you see in a lot of mixes, and it is an exopolysaccharide emulsifier. So basically, it's a sugar residual that's secreted by a microorganism. And in the places where it's processed, there could be some wheat residues. But basically, it's glucose and sucrose or lactose, which is fermented by this bacteria. And then isopropyl alcohol is used to extract it, and it's dried. And basically the safety is 15 grams a day would be safe. And I don't think you use anywhere near that. But the issue with the xanthan gum is you have to be a little bit aware that it could have a laxative effect, or it could cause some bloating in and of itself. So, you know, if you try one of these pre-made bread recipes or pre-flackaged flour, or things that have xanthan gum. And if you look on the back of things, there's a lot of xanthan gum, even if you looked at coconut milk on the shelf or anything, because it's going to be a thickener or a stabilizer. You know, that could be a source of some of your bloating. Psyllium fiber, basically corn husk, is a natural fiber. It's decreased, low in cholesterol. When it becomes wet, it actually becomes gelatinous. And it will, you know, adding a little bit to bread improves the, you know, the characteristics of bread. Again, you need to use a little bit more water to make that stick, but that's a very healthy alternative. It also could be somewhat of a laxative because of the increased fiber. So if someone's not used to fiber, that could be an issue. Of course, chia seeds, you know, become very gelatinous when adding to water, and that happens very quick. And they're a soluble fiber. They have a very good omega-3 to 6 profile. It's 3 omegas, 3 to 1 to 6. So chia seeds are always very good, same as flax seeds, you know, a good omega-3 source. If you're going to use the flax seeds, they need to be ground and add it with water. Flax seeds need to sit a little bit longer than the chia seeds. And then the other one, agar-agar. Which is a gelatin substitute bulking effect. This is made from seaweed, and it really is gooey if you've ever tried this, and a little sticky, but that will thicken things somewhere along the lines of, say, of cornstarch, but not quite as powdery. And then there's locust bean gum, which is extracted from the seeds of the carob tree. It is a combination of the sugars galactose and mannose, and it comes from the pod. The carob powder comes from the pod, not the seed, and the locust bean comes from the seed. So, I mean, they're all safe as far as, you know, there's not a whole lot of processing. I guess xanthan gum with the extraction with the alcohol might have a little bit of more processing. But there's this, you know, none of them are derived from some chemical experiment. So, you know, I think what I've seen in some breads, you know, to make a pizza crust or some breads, people tend to use a little bit of xanthan gum as a binder. And then again, you know, the extra baking powder, extra baking soda. And if you said 25% increase, would you say if it was 1 teaspoon, just for guessing, would you just add 2 teaspoons? How would you go about that? Because you know, when I see you in the kitchen, you're always playing with the baking soda and the baking powder.
Yeah, you know, don't do what I say, not what I do, because typically I'm just kind of throwing it in to see what works. And, you know, with leavening agents, all the chefs and bakers out there will probably cringe. But, you know, my experience, especially with vegan baking, a little bit more won't kill you. It usually won't hurt. But if you were going to do like 25% more, just kind of simple math, if you're doing a teaspoon, adding an extra quarter teaspoon to kind of just add on a little bit. So it's not a lot, just a little bit, you know. And like I said, if you do a little bit extra, it's just going to be a little fluffier. And sometimes that's not a bad thing. So
Yeah, and then, you know, anytime you get a chance to add some flaxseed or chia seed, I think that's kind of a good thing to add.
And chia seed, you know, sorry to cut you off there, but just they're great in baked goods as well as, you know, I'm not asking you to go down there and, you know, bake up all these muffins and eat them daily. But when you do, just kind of they add a little bit of a subtle crunch as well as those omega-3s that you're getting. And they do very well with baked goods, the chia seeds. I have experienced versus a flax seed, so.
That's very good. And then, you know, I like the crunch of millet, you know, to put the millet seeds in with some of the, you know, and you can process that in a Vitamix. Actually, you can just throw the millet seeds right in your Vitamix and spin that to get your millet flour, but it still gives a little bit of a crunch to things. If we look at pancakes, we've been using teff flour, and teff flour is a really good flour to mix with, put a little cacao powder in there to make a chocolate pancake. I also do a combination of either oat and cornmeal or teff and cornmeal, and that makes a really good pancake.
Or you can do all oat flour, so 1-to-1, 1 cup of oats and 1 cup of flour and or almond milk or plant milk of your choice in the blender. Is how, if you're, you know, a member of our practice and I've sent you over some recipes, I've probably sent you over our blender pancakes. And those are gluten-free as long as you're using a labeled gluten-free oat brand. So, yes.
And again, I'm going to make another plug while we're at it, because if you join our mailing list, we're sending out some of these recipes all the time. So, you know, that's a good way to get some of the recipes that were on the talk today. I take my nutrition classes shopping, and everybody's just feverishly writing down things, and it's a really fun time. But afterwards they say, this is great, but I didn't get all these recipes that you talked about. So I've, you know, developed, we do a sheet the week after, and we talk about all the things we saw in the grocery store and all the different vegetables and in different recipes. So we kind of go over it twice, because when you're just hearing this off the cuff, sometimes it's hard to catch some of the things. And, you know, don't be afraid to experiment. Most of the time, you know, these things turn out really good. But just keep a good food log, I think, is the key to you know, helping your healthcare provider sort these things out. And, you know, really noting whether or not something is processed, and really noting when you go out and, you know, when do you feel bad? Is it in the morning, or is it in the afternoon? Is it after a particular, if it's Pizza Friday every night and Saturday and Sunday, you typically feel worse, you know, or is it Monday when you have to go back to work and you're all stressed out? So, you know, kind of, you know, make a mental note and actually jot it down in your journal, so we can, you know, kind of help sort these things out when we hear from you. So what's on the horizon? Any other tips or tricks for listeners here today? Christmas baking. Yeah. How about you want to throw just a little hint of Christmas baking in? I mean, maybe the bean, you know, there's black bean brownies. You know, those are kind of a good thing, that, you know, more beans, less grain products, the chia seed type, or I'm sorry, the chickpea type of cookies. Again, you know, less grains. That's always an alternative.
Yeah, and, you know, using, you know, you don't have to go out and get, I mean, by all means, if you want to, excuse me, go out and get the vegan cookbooks and the vegan baking books, have at it. But if you have some old recipes that your family has used for a while, you know, it's not all that daunting once you take a deep breath to convert them to a plant-based option. So, you know, instead of oils, using pureed fruits such as bananas or applesauce, or pumpkin even. So anything in that kind of consistency is great for an oil substitute. You know, and then, like, we've talked about a few egg substitutes that also serve as further binders with gluten-free things. So yeah, so, you know, and cookies too, fortunately, with the gluten-free things, just because, you know, rising and leavening is usually an issue, cookies usually, you know, you're not too worried about that. So there's definite alternatives. You do not, all is not lost. Going plant-based as we have said before, and definitely all is not lost going gluten-free. You can still live a happy, healthy life, just making sure that you are doing what is best for you health-wise and what's necessary versus a fad.
Very good. All right. Well, I think that that pretty much wraps it up here for this week. You know, we'll look forward to hearing from you. Certainly, if you have any, Addie has one more thing to say here, I guess. Yes.
And I just want to point out, too, if you are not a subscriber to our practice newsletter that is for you all, not just our cool member newsletter, which they get monthly as well, this is the month, you know, of December. So I will be adding on a few recipes that may be a little bit to help with your sweet tooth this time of year and some tips and tricks in there. So head on over to our website. Go and check out how to get signed up for our newsletter. So even if you aren't a member, you can kind of just get a taste of what our cool Plant Strong team gets on a monthly basis.
And the other thing is, you know, over the holiday season, make sure you keep moving, you know, it's go out and get your walk, get the walk in the evening after dinner or before dinner. We just finished a step challenge for the practice over the month of November, and you know, and now we're moving into some other challenges, but make sure you get your walking in and keep your exercise program up. The holidays can be really tough, both from an eating aspect and going to parties, but it can also be somewhat emotionally difficult. And we know that exercise helps with both of those. So, you know, get your walk, your swim, your bike, ride in every day, and keep moving. Go out and get some fresh air. I think if you can get out and see the sunshine, or if you live up north, the clouds anyway, some fresh wind will kind of open things up and make you feel really good. So until next time, if you have any questions, you can email us at Addie@drdelaney.com. And again, doctor is spelled out DocterDulaney, or Jamie@drdelaney.com. Check out the website at drdelaney.com. And we'll look forward to speaking with you soon. See you later.